Welcome to the London Buddhist Centre's podcast, bringing you the Dharma and guided meditations. If you found value in listening, please consider making a donation. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Very, very good indeed to see you all here in this shrine room, which I had a hand in creating. I remember coming here before we'd actually taken it on. This was where the fire engines were. One there, one there. They came in through the doors there. And it was sort of slightly burnt out. Anyway, enough of reminiscence. Each time I come, I give a series of three what I call rambles, which licenses me to be very imprecise and unsystematic. And I often come with titles that I want to speak to. But last time, and it's the same this time, I felt I rather wanted to respond to what other people thought was important. And Satchadasa set me three essays last time, which I seem to have come out of quite creditably. So I asked him to give me three titles for this time. So what happens now is not my responsibility at all. It's Satchadasa's. The general title is Modern Dharma Challenges. Now, I assume those are challenges for me to talk about, but probably what he really intended was these are challenges that people bring to the Dharma. When they begin to engage with the Dharma, these are thoughts in their minds, questions that they have. Maybe they're the sort of questions that some of you will have. So tonight's question is, I have to read it for myself, but as Surya Gupta already read to you, will mindfulness really help undo the knot of anxiety and depression? Will it really do it, not just say it will on the poster and so forth? Will it actually bring about an untying of the knot of anxiety and depression? Perhaps will it cut the Gordian knot of anxiety and depression? So this is what I have to talk to today. In brief, I'd say yes and no. Mm-hmm. Okay. It will help, but it won't be enough. That's broadly what I want to say. And I'm going to illustrate what I mean in the next 45, 50 minutes. So let's take the question and analyse it a bit. Well, first of all, we need to take the term mindfulness. This is such a common term that even today in the House of Commons, in the Houses of Parliament, there's a parliamentary mindfulness group. They really need it. but it's a substantial number of MPs and peers apparently attend this group, as well as bureaucrats who are servicing the parliament and so forth. So it's become a really common term, which probably most people have some general idea of what it means. About 6 or 7 years ago, we had a hustings here for the mayoral elections. Manjusiha organised, and we wanted them to answer questions coming from Buddhists, and they were asked, what do you think of, or what will you do to promote mindfulness in the borough of Tower Hamlets? Every one of them had something to say. Every one of them applauded the idea of mindfulness. It doesn't mean that they know what it means or that they'll do it. They are politicians, after all. But every one of them felt this was something that they should be able to say something, as it were, constructive, creative about. And some of them, you know, really obviously meant it. You know, from UKIP all the way across the political spectrum. They all honoured mindfulness. But what does it actually mean? I noticed the village I live, which is quite remote in North Wales. You know, occasionally I go shopping and look at the notice board, and there are at least two local mindfulness trainers, if my Welsh is good enough to understand what it's about. So it's everywhere. mindfulness is everywhere, and it's now just an accepted part of the what a sort of good possibility is. The Welsh government, which is actually rather good, has a welfare set of welfare targets, one of which is to get mindfulness training into every school in Wales. But what do they mean by mindfulness? Is that practice of mindfulness going to, is it really going to help undo the knot of anxiety and depression? Of course, what mindfulness means as a practice is bringing awareness to all aspects, especially of one's own experience, one's own immediate experience, bringing mindfulness to one's body, being aware of what's going on with your body, what your body is doing, so that when you make a gesture, you're aware of making the gesture. Whereas so often, you know, we're fiddling and twisting and so forth, we don't know what we're doing. And if people point it out, we're a bit shocked. But we bring mindfulness to all our actions so that they flow smoothly and not in a controlled way, but in a natural way. We bring mindfulness to our emotional life so we know what we're feeling. And we bring a mindfulness, we bring awareness to our thoughts so we know what the currents of thinking are. And with good mindfulness training, you're taught to work with your mind, just as we do in general classes here, as Kushala Sara was mentioning you do on a retreat, working how to deal with the mind's chatter, with the mind's sometimes destructive patterns of thought and so forth. And there's certainly no doubt that mindfulness will help you to change in these respects. You will become more conscious of where your body is, what it's doing, what's going on inside your body. After all, a lot of our health problems are things that if we had more mindfulness, we'd be aware were deleterious. They were having a bad effect upon us, the things we put in our bodies and the things we do with our bodies. If we were aware of the effects, we wouldn't do them so much. So bringing mindfulness to our bodies will help us to get general health, a general sense of well-being. The Buddha says that if you bring mindfulness to the body, it brings calmness so that you're less agitated by what he calls likes and dislikes. You're less affected by, you know, things that appeal to you and things that don't appeal to you, not thrown around by your predilections and prejudices. You become more stable and so on. A huge effect. Just being mindful of the body is a very strong effect upon one's whole experience. When you bring mindfulness to your emotions, you no longer emote unconsciously, which means that, you know, we're often driven by emotions that we don't see, we don't know. You know, it's the sort of thing where you're shouting at somebody, they say, "You're really angry," and you say, "No, I'm not." When we become more aware of our emotions, we're more able to work with them so that they're more constructive, more positive, if you like, more creative. And when we work with our thinking processes, our mental patterns and so forth, we're able to turn them in a more constructive direction, bringing about greater happiness and so forth. So absolutely no question that practice of mindfulness will benefit you as a human being. You'll be a better, happier human being if you practice mindfulness systematically. I don't think that's really doubtable. It's beyond doubt. And I believe there are good empirical evidence for the effects of mindfulness training. Raw, basic mindfulness training. It's shown to promote well-being of both body and mind. Of course, it'll improve your relations with other people, because if you're more aware of yourself, you'll be less impulsive and destructive in your behaviour with others, and so on. You can see being mindful, practicing mindfulness, developing mindfulness is clearly going to be beneficial. But will it undo the knot of anxiety and depression, or will it help to undo the knot of anxiety and depression? It's very interesting, the question is framed, the knot of anxiety and depression. It's not just your knot of anxiety and depression, or a person's knot of anxiety and depression, but the knot of anxiety and depression. I'm going to read into it what the questioner, what Satchidasa may not have intended, but I think he's talking about, I think the question suggests something that's bigger than us as individuals. It's a cultural phenomenon. There's a general sense of anxiety, a general sense of depression, widely within certainly British culture. Of course, some of you come from other countries, other cultures within Britain. But I think still within Britain, at least, and perhaps in other European, West European countries, certainly in North America, at least north of the Rio Grande, there's a wide prevalence of anxiety and depression. People talk of an epidemic of depression, and depression and anxiety very closely connected, and statistics show that the huge numbers of people experience depression during their lives. Huge numbers. And one can't help thinking, I can't help thinking of my own experience of very different cultures. I've been going to India for the last, nearly 40 years. I go for about 6 months every year, and I'm working with people in our movement, on our Tri Ratna movement in India, who all come from, mostly, almost all come from the lowest level of the caste system, who were formerly considered untouchable. Now the sort of general term is Dalit, which means downtrodden. I don't even like that term, actually, but they are the people who are really disadvantaged in the system of caste, which is absolutely dominant in India. They suffer many disadvantages, which we won't go into at this point. But there was a mass conversion in 1956 to Buddhism as a way out of the caste system which is embedded in Hinduism. So they were led out of Hinduism by the great Dr. Ambedkar, B.R. Ambedkar. He's a very important figure that people should know about. Maybe that's a subject for another time. I hope we're going to celebrate his conversion this year. And hundreds of thousands, later millions of them, turned to Buddhism. And our own teacher was involved with that conversion movement, and we have ourselves followed it up. Now, something like a third of our order members worldwide are from that background. And what I see when I work in India, and as I say, I've been working there for quite a number of years. I have very many deep friendships there. I don't find much of the knot of anxiety and depression. I don't find, of course, there are people with mental problems. There are people who have been in really terrible situations who clearly suffer from that. But as a sort of prevalent phenomenon, I wouldn't describe there as being the knot of anxiety and depression in India. Whereas here, people tell me, I was speaking to somebody who'd been running a youth retreat at Adishtana, saying that almost everybody on that retreat had some form of anxiety or depression. Almost everybody. And so yes, I also have been recently working in Mexico, south of the Rio Grande, and it's a very different culture. It's not Los Estados Unidos. It's not the gringos. It's very different. It's a much more traditional culture. And I don't see the knot of anxiety and depression there. Interestingly enough, I also have some connection with a group of Roma in Hungary. I've been going out, I was before the pandemic, but I've been going out twice a year just to support them. We have some mitras there, and they're running a school for Roma youth who just don't fit in the education system, partly for racist reasons, partly because their whole background is sort of alien to the culture of the schools. I don't find that knot of anxiety and depression there. Maybe I don't know it well enough, but I have a lot of friends there. I don't see that knot of anxiety and depression. So that makes one wonder, what is it that's happening in our, particularly in the Anglosphere, you might say. But perhaps it's also in Western Europe that I'm not so aware of. But there does seem to be something about the culture which many of us come from, even if we occupy different sections of it, using culture in the broadest term, which seems to promote, or rather seems to lead to, the knot of anxiety and depression. This is my impression. Maybe I'm completely wrong. It's not an empirical judgment. It's the empiricism of my own eyes, if you see what I mean, rather than of some study. But I believe there are studies that support this. So just being aware, more aware, it will certainly help. So yeah, the question is correct, that mindfulness will really help. But it will only really help to some extent. Because unless we really understand what the nature of the problem is, we won't be able to find an adequate solution to it. So I'm going to give you my analysis of the problem, which is definitely a Buddhist analysis. I think what's happened to us, especially since the Second World War, is that we've become an increasingly alienated culture. We're increasingly alienated from each other. We're alienated from our landscape, even. We're alienated from any sense of something higher. I'm generalizing wildly. You may not see yourself in what I'm saying. But I think if you look around, you probably will notice what I'm talking about. There's a loss of meaning. What is the real purpose of our lives? And because we have such extraordinary wealth and such an efficient economy, we can have pretty much whatever we want at the touch of a button on the what do you call those things? Computer. gratifications are instantaneous. And we've become increasingly choosy, increasingly believing that we are entitled to whatever we can get. We've become increasingly, have an increasing sense that we have a right to happiness. We have a right to well-being. I've just recently been reading a biography of a very famous English literary figure who lived in the 17th century. Sorry, this is the way my mind works. It was a doctor in Norwich. And he faced illness that was all around him. The expectation of life was about 50. And he was, as a doctor, constantly dealing with people who are dying when he didn't know what to do about it. But what's very striking is that he never presents himself as needing to, it being his failure if he didn't know. He did his best, but he didn't always succeed. And he never presents his patients as blaming him for not succeeding. Whereas now we believe that we are entitled to good health. I'm exaggerating, but you know what I mean? These sort of attitudes, you're there. We feel somehow the doctors have failed if we've not got good health. And I've had doctors say to me that people come and shout at them because they're ill. As if it's the doctor's fault that, you know, they're leading a lousy life and smoking, you know, cigarettes and etc. etc. Sorry if you smoke cigarettes. Stop it, but it's all right. It's not good for you. I'm sure you've heard that enough on your packet. oh dear, get out of this hole. But there's this sort of sense you're entitled to be happy, you're entitled to be healthy, and that there's something wrong. The government's done something wrong if it's not as that as it is. Somebody is to blame for your suffering. Maybe these are not very explicit or expressed. It's just not the way people think in a traditional society. But we've grown a society in which it seems as if we have a right to happiness, a right to well-being, without feeling we have any duty to do something about it. Exaggerating wildly, but sometimes exaggeration reveals something. The harsh light of the sun reveals a shadow which isn't there when it's a bit more twilighty. So, we've created a culture in which it's all about me. All about me and my entitlements. And we're increasingly cut off from the whole context which in a traditional society you have. I mentioned last time, I talked about roots last time. And I mentioned staying with a Buddhist family in Ladakh, in a very remote valley which is cut off, or used to be, it's no longer, but it used to be cut off for 6 months of the year by snow. And it's a very traditional Tibetan cultural society. We stayed with a family. They were very, very nice people, very kind to us. And we had a chance to sort of see their lives up close. And they were so sort of stable on the ground, so comfortable in their own skin, as the expression has it. They were so confident about their own beliefs. For instance, I mentioned last time, they had a sort of bundle up in the roof in the attic, which was their gods, the family gods, just like in Roman times, the Lares and what are they? Anyway, you know, the household gods. They knew the landscape absolutely intimately. They knew its whole history, where you know, where their families had come from, up that side valley. They knew their local monastery. They had a connection with the Rinpoche there, and so forth. They lived completely in a context that gave them tremendous confidence and sense of well-being. Whatever their status, they felt at peace with themselves, at peace with the world around them. I'm sure they have their problems, but in the sense of the knot of anxiety and depression, they just weren't like that. They were quite at ease in their environment. It's a very beautiful environment, which certainly helped, but a very tough one, very, very tough. Cut off by snow for 6 months a year. Can't get out of your house for three of those months, maybe. A really tough environment. So, yes, we're not like that. We don't have that setting. We don't have that surrounding. It's slowly eroded. And thank goodness, to be honest, because even in Ladakh, I saw how limited the opportunities were for individual choice. You basically had to fit in. Fitting in was, for most people, a really rewarding experience. But, of course, for some people, it was very restrictive. They had the monasteries. They could go to the monasteries, or they could become hermits in the mountains. So they did have options, but... there you are, you've got an option. but yes, they couldn't really... very difficult to be different. It would not be acceptable. That's the problem with traditional societies. They offer you great sense of security and of knowing who you are, but they don't allow you much latitude. You've just got to fit in, which, as I say, is kind of not a bad thing insofar as it gives rewards. In a way, I was brought up in the remnants of that in our own culture. You know, since I was born in the 18th century, yes. like Mudita Shri, yes. you know, I was born just after the Second World War. And, you know, my parents belonged to that old white British culture, which is strongly class-based, and where everybody knew their place. You knew your direction. I knew, because of the class that I was born into, what kind of a career I should have. Fortunately, the Beatles and LSD came along. And that was that. But I remember, you know, my parents. I remember that my parents' associates. I remember people in the village that I brought up in. Again, that sense of comfort in their own skin. They knew who they were. Even if they were from a disadvantaged section of society, they still felt a sort of a pride and confidence in that. You know, like the old working class. Tremendous sense of pride. That slowly disintegrated. It's disintegrated over the course of my life, and I played quite a big part in making it disintegrate. I'm not taking responsibility for everything, my generation, the baby boomers, were the ones who gradually dismantled the remnants of the traditional society in the old white British traditional society. Systematically and consciously dismantled it and replaced it with pretty much nothing. We're with anything, let's say. Again, you know, I'm talking in very dark and shade, no, light and shade terms. I'm not being very nuanced about it. But there's a gradual loss of this sense of a traditional society, which meant, of course, that there was greater freedom for creativity, greater freedom for individuality, which is a great gain. And that is really the great gain of modern times, that we do have the possibility to pursue some creative direction relatively unchecked. Limitations of economics, the only one, really. Nobody's going to disapprove of you for being very different, particularly in Britain, where we specialise in being indifferent to each other. certainly white British society, anyway. So we slowly disintegrated all that. And we can't go back. We can't, you'll be glad to hear, recreate a class system. We can't recreate a traditional society. It's gone. It's over. The cat is out of the bag. It's happened. It's done. The modern era. Now, of course, the postmodern era is the reality of the present. What we have to do is recreate the positive equivalent of that traditional society, which will give us the sense of confidence in who we are, the sense of who we belong with, what our context is, and what this wretched life is for. That's the big thing about the modernism and postmodernism, is the collapse of, as it were, metaphysical certainties. The collapse of a real sense of why we're living this life. We still live just about on the remnants of Christian ethics, but they're Christian ethics largely without their underpinning. It's, you know, a tree that has been cut, which hasn't yet fallen to the ground, but it's on the way. And we've lost a sense of a shared sense of a common world. you know, you see sort of interesting events like, you know, the Queen's funeral, and they're trying to do it with a coronation. I have a horrible feeling it's not going to quite work, but it's rapidly disintegrating. It's rapidly falling apart. And hooray and boo-hoo at the same time. Something is gained, something is lost. But we have to individually and collectively recreate something that gives us the same sense of knowing who we are and where we belong. The very important sutta in the Pali Canon called the Sigalavada Sutta. I'm not going to tell you the whole story of this sutta, but it's a very important one and often quoted. The sutta is based around an incident in which the Buddha is out with his followers wandering, as they used to do, from town to town, or village to village, and he comes across a young man on the riverbank who's just had a bath in the river, presumably a ritual bath in the river, and is on the riverbank, and he's bowing in the four directions, east, south, west, and north. And he bows down, and he bows up. So the Buddha asks him, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I don't know." He says, "My father said I should do this every day, and so to honour my father, I do this." That's interesting, to honour his father, he did it. And so the Buddha says, well, I'll teach you what the significance of what you're doing is. So the east is your parents, you're bowing to your parents. The south is your teachers. The west is your spouse, your family, your partner and your family. And the north is your friends and companions. Below you are those people who work for you, like lawyers and doctors and people like that. No laugh there. Well, I remember Bhante once saying to me when I was going to see a lawyer about some matter, and I was a bit nervous about it, and he said, "Just remember, they're your servants. You're paying them." Because we tend to think that they're somehow sort of authorities, but actually they're just your paid, your hired servants. I think actually he said worse than that. But the people, if you're a boss or a manager or whatever, you have people working for you. So they are, as it were, you're saluting them below. And then, of course, above are those who are to be honoured, those who are serious practitioners of the path, who are following the spiritual path, and all of it in the context of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. So he outlines what each bow means. I'm not going to go into it in detail. It's a very important sutta and worth very close study, and Bhante did study it, so we've got a basis for that. But what he does in each case is say what the reciprocal duties are. So the duty of the son or daughter to the parents, and then what the duties of the parents are to the son or daughter, what the duties are of the student to the teacher, what the duties of the teacher are to the pupil, and so on. In every case, there's the reciprocal duties. That's not the way we think nowadays. We think in terms of rights. Rights, Sangharakshita famously says, are only relevant when people do not do their duty. So when the government, for instance, does not do its duty by you, then the question of rights arise. It's in fact, originally, the notion of rights is a legal term. It comes from Roman jurisprudence. But it's become extended much further than that. But in a healthy society, we see ourselves as existing within a network of reciprocal duties. What I owe to you, what you owe to me. My concern is what I owe to you, not with what you owe to me. Of course, if you owe me something that is really important and neglect that, then I may have to claim my rights. But if everybody does their duty, the question of rights doesn't arise. And so a healthy society is one in which you conceive yourself as bound into a network of duties. And this is what we try to create at a centre like this. We try to create a situation where people have duties to each other, and where we can create in a new way, in a conscious way, what a traditional society would give one, where you have creative, positive relations with all those different elements of one's experience, of creative, positive relations with one's parents. It's very strongly emphasised by us, by our teachers. Creative relationships, positive relationships, duties, reciprocal duties with your teachers, with your partner and family, with your friends, with people who work for you, and with those who, as it were, exemplars on the path. We try to create a context within which everybody has a place where they have duties and which other people have duties to them. It's not static. It's always going to be changing. It's dynamic. But there's a sense that you belong within a collective framework, which gives you a tremendous sense of confidence in yourself. I remember as a young man, I was extremely unconfident. I was so busy taking LSD and listening to the Beatles that I lost my confidence in myself, which it'd been bred into me. But with the collapse of the old world, that went. But through coming in contact with a teacher, through being part of a community where I had a place, where I had duties, and people had duties to me, I've rebuilt my confidence and created a natural confidence, if you like. So we have to recreate it. And you'll find as you are able to engage with that, if you are able to engage with that, whether here or somewhere else, a deep sense of confidence and satisfaction, a sense of you know who you are. There's a big question today, isn't it? Question of identity. Who are we? But if you belong identity isn't something independent, as it were, existing independent of context. Identity is to do with your context, those who are around you, what your life is fundamentally about. And that is the most important thing. This whole structure, as it were, of reciprocal duties exists within a context of value. And this is, I think, the most important and deepest thing that is missing today, a sense of shared values, a sense that life has a particular meaning, that we are here for some purpose. From a Buddhist point of view, we're here to develop ourselves and to benefit others, to develop ourselves ultimately towards enlightenment. And if we can live our lives on the basis of that deep meaning, really engage with that deep meaning and the values that follow from that, the ethical values, the social values that follow from that, we'll have a very strong sense of satisfaction, of peace with ourselves, peace with what is around us, and strength with which to deal with the difficulties that the world will throw at us. I remember that many years ago I started doing a kind of meditation practice, a ritual meditation practice called prostrations. So in this practice we set up in front of us a symbolic tree in imagination, in visualization. We set up an imaginary tree which has on it all our values. The Buddha is there. The Buddha is the past, present and the future. The Dhamma is there. The Sangha is there, both in its archetypal and its historic form. Our own teachers and our teachers' teachers are there. Then all the great Buddhists of the past are there, and then the Buddha on the highest possible level, as it were, the Buddha in his real self, if you like. And we set that up before us, and then we prostrate ourselves again and again in front of it, saying, I go for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. And I remember the first time I did this practice, at night I had a very, very powerful dream, which I won't recount to you, but the dream was communicating to me the sense of, at last, I know where I belong in the universe. This is where I stand in relation to what is really important. You have your father behind your right shoulder, your mother behind your left shoulder. You have all your friends around you. You have all other beings around you, all prostrating in front of the refuge tree. So you have a strong sense of who you are, where you stand, how you stand in relation to others. And gradually that knot of anxiety and depression dissolves. It won't happen immediately. One may have particular issues one has to come to terms with to do with one's own personal conditioning. That happens, and happens a lot. But with that context, yes, this knot, the knot of anxiety and depression that is so prevalent, that predominates, you might say, in the atmosphere of a country like this, gradually dissolves. So, if you like, our invitation is to engage with this context where you can find opportunities to, well, enter into reciprocal duties with others, where they owe something to you, you owe something to them. Duty here is not a dirty word. In India, if somebody kind of brings something to you, if they kind of give you a drink or something like that, you thank them, and they say, oh, don't thank me, mera zimidari hai, it's my duty. And often people from outside India react and say, no, it's not your duty. But it's a positive thing for them. They don't see it as something negative, they see it as something positive. Doing your duty is something desirable. It's a deep satisfaction when you do your duty, because your duty is aligned with what is important to you and what you believe this life is all about. So we provide an opportunity to engage in the creation of a culture. We're only at the beginnings of it, and we've got much to learn. We make many mistakes, but we're trying to create a culture within which anybody, no matter what their background, can engage in this network of reciprocal duties in the context of the highest possible ideals. And yes, I'm very confident that anybody who does feel that knot of anxiety and depression will find that slowly dissolving. Mindfulness will certainly help, but mindfulness within that larger context will go far further and far deeper and resolve that knot of anxiety and depression at a much, much deeper level, at the deepest level of all. Thank you very much.